There's an old picture I absolutely love. It's of a suburban scene in Brisbane in maybe the 1940s or 50s in a suburb called Paddington, which these days is considered inner city and is pretty bougie, but back then was a worker's suburb. And the photo shows the back of a row of house blocks stretching up the street in uniformity. At the front, neat workers' cottages, and they're each backed by a stretch of grass containing an outdoor toilet, an incinerator, and a veggie patch. It's the sort of backyard that used to be part of the Australian dream, but a shift has happened over time. Block sizes for new houses across our cities have shrunk 22% in the past 15 years, according to the ABS. The average block size is now 467 square metres. But while the size of land is shrinking, house sizes are not. We're building bigger houses with smaller yards. So, RIP the backyard. What does it mean for our communities if backyards become a rarity? And in a tick, you'll hear what swapping our backyards for hard surfaces is doing to our cities with a couple of people who've been looking at the data. But first, Costa Georgiadis is a landscape architect and host of Gardening Australia. Costa, welcome to Life Matters.
Hello, Tegan. Thanks for the chance to come on.
I'm stoked to have you on. I want to hear about your backyard, Costa.
Oh, wow. When you mentioned it, and I've been thinking about it since yesterday, when I think about my backyard, I actually think about that side of my childhood where we had like an interconnected network between all my friends in the street, and we could climb the fences and jump and run alongside passages and get down to the next house. And we could literally move from one end of the street to the other without having any contact on the actual streetscape itself. And, you know, our backyard, well, when I first grew up, it was multi-leveled, and there was this old concrete fish tank at the bottom, and there were citrus trees and things. And then when I was in year three, my parents put a swimming pool in, and I remember, Tegan, I was given permission to come home in the middle of the day and watch the digger digging
so
the hole,
good.
Which, you know, in year three, like in a digger, like that was a big thing. And like that changed the backyard, but we then had a whole new chapter of life there. And you know, I'm looking, I think what I looked out on the street in those days into my neighbors' backyards, one of them had a massive pine tree. And I remember we used to build these big cubbies with tarpaulins because one of our friends' dads was a truck driver, and he'd bring these tarpaulins and big cardboard boxes, and we'd build them until we'd get to the trunk, and then we'd climb this massive pine tree. And particularly in the wind, we'd love doing it in the wind because when you're at the top, it would sway about a metre and a half to 2 metres. And it was another world, and we literally spent our time on the street. And the one rule was, and I'm sure lots of listeners had this same kind of policy, we had to be back in the street before the streetlights came on.
Yeah.
And that was where we spent our lives, in the nature. Well, I'd call it the naturehood. You know, it was the neighbourhood of nature.
Costa, in my mind's eye, when I'm picturing you as a little 8 or 9 year old kid running around feral in the backyard, you've still got your giant beard. What's going on there?
That was from birth.
A feature of your entire life.
So freak of nature.
So that's your childhood, and I think it's a childhood that lucky Aussies really probably resonate with. But when you're talking to people through your work with Gardening Australia, what are they telling you about their backyards today?
Well, I think, you know, it comes back to a lot of these concepts that I learnt about and explored in my landscape architecture degree. And, you know, it comes down to that idea of proxemics and space and, you know, the physical layout of our homes and our communities. And, you know, how humans use the space and how that affects not just our behaviour but our social interaction. And using my street as an example, Tegan, like I remember all the fences were low and you could look across the front yard into the windows, see the people interacting. I knew everyone on the street. And then the first high fence went up with the garage door right on the boundary. Mm. And then the second and then the third. And watching this evolve over the last 30 years, then suddenly more and more houses had closed that social space. The proxemics then went from fence line to fence line with walls. And then what's happened now is those houses, they're now being divided into two. So they were single dwellings. Now they're being knocked down and divided into two. The building opposite, or the house opposite, which used to be, I think it was the Indian consulate there for many years, that got bought, and the house next door to it, and there's now 18 apartments there. So, you know, this is the reality of this, you know, pressure on dense. Well, the consequence is that you know, green space is getting smaller, and this is what I'm seeing with people. And so they're asking more, how can I grow in small space? I've only got this narrow courtyard or a rooftop or a balcony, and it's the reality that more and more people are facing.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to Costa Georgiadis. You know his voice. He's from Gardening Australia, because we're talking about backyards today. Backyards are shrinking. Our house blocks are getting smaller. Our houses are getting bigger. And as we're hearing from Costa, it has an effect on how we interact with each other in a community. But it has other effects too, as you're about to hear from two experts in urban planning and sustainability. Anna says, I went from a lush backyard to a concrete jungle. I planted in pots, magnolia, pine trees, peppercorn, and more. Well, with me is Professor Joe Hurley from the Centre for Urban Research at RMIT University, and Dr. Tami Cruiser, Deputy Associate Director of Regenerative Environments and Climate Action, also at RMIT. Joe, I might start with you. What's driving this smaller block size and larger house trend?
Well, you've mentioned a couple of the key points already, Tegan, and indeed Costa. We've got redevelopment in our cities, and that's always an ongoing process. We've got these reducing block sizes, but alongside that, as you've touched on, increasing house sizes, we actually have the dubious record of having the largest average house size in the world. So we are supersizing our houses.
Even bigger than America.
Even than America, that's right. Wow. America just pips us on average per person, but on the average size, you know, we're on top of the leaderboard there.
Mm. Tami, there's personal benefits to having a backyard. We've spoken about that a little bit, but society and the environment also benefits, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's a range of reasons why we need backyards, and it was lovely hearing the social aspects, but you know, we had the National Climate Risk Assessment come out in September, which said we're probably going to see a doubling to quadrupling of heat waves. If we're losing the greening that's on our private properties, we are really that much more exposed to heatwave risks. And study after study has shown you can't really get enough tree canopy to protect a neighbourhood from those heatwave risks just on streets and parks. We do need some greenery on private property to keep us safe from heat. And that's just one of a range of reasons why you'd need that stuff. I'm happy to talk about more.
Yeah, talk to me about it. What other features are there?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you imagine why people go and live in the suburbs, for many of us, it's, you know, you want that greenery, that access to nature. Many of us, it's also for our kids. And one of the things I think could be so sad is if we end up growing up without our kids seeing native birds, native insects, native animals, and they're just seeing pigeons and cockroaches because everything's been absolutely concreted. So part of my work looks at how we get biodiversity into urban areas. In fact, we had a paper accepted today looking at what you need. And it's really the layering. And, you know, someone like Austin knows how to layer a garden beautifully. It's really gardens where you can do a little bit of understory with flowers, a little bit of shrubbery, especially little birds. They love that kind of stuff. Low trees, higher trees. That's what creates good habitat for native creatures. You can do a little bit of that in streets in some places around the world, like Fremantle, actually, in Perth. They're pretty good at getting a little bit of layering in their streetscapes, but your average streetscape is just trees. So that layering for biodiversity, so that your kids actually see, you know, lorikeets or blue-banded bees instead of just cockroaches, that's really crucial for our lived experience and for our children's development.
Joe, don't we have a need, though, for higher density in our cities? Like, we've got so many people, not everyone can have a quarter acre and a giant backyard. We would end up with other environmental problems if we did that.
100%, Tegan. So it's not that development is bad, but we're looking at the ways we develop in cities, that the nature of development, the location is critical. So one of our research projects is really looking forensically at development across our five largest cities, the nature of the development, the location of the development, using image detection algorithms to look at that location, what's happening, and get a better understanding of where that change is happening and the nature of that change. What we want to see is more intensified development providing housing supply in really well-located areas. So, you know, Costa talked about that apartment in his childhood neighbourhood. That's probably a good addition to the landscape given the housing pressures we have. But what we're seeing, more dominant form of development, is a much more dispersed, low-level development. The two-lot subdivision, again, that Costa pointed to. But even worse from a housing supply point of view is this proliferation of one-for-one housing development, what is often called the knockdown rebuild. Now, all of these forms of development, sort of regardless of how much housing they create, generally do the same thing for our gardens, for our lots. They increase the building size, they increase the impervious surfaces, the driveways, the patios, the swimming pools, and they reduce the permeable and vegetation coverage of those sites. They get rid of the garden. So the way that plays out and accumulates across our suburbs and neighbourhoods is really important. It's about development that's good quality in the right locations, increasing house supply, not just a bland spread across the whole suburban landscape, low-level intensification.
And Joe, even on house, like traditional house blocks, we're seeing the house footprint get a lot bigger. You call this the Jamie Dury effect. Please explain.
Oh, look, that's, I'm not sure that,
claim it.
All respect to Jamie Dury and other landscape architects, but there's something about the changing nature of the way we're using our blocks. Really, it's being driven by the supersized house. But alongside that is, you know, a partly bound up in this kind of like aspirational asset class nature of housing that seems to come before making a home, the kind of stories that Costa was alluding to. This, you know, wanting to keep investing, and maybe it's an outdoor room, you know, a second kitchen, a barbecue setup, a swimming pool, a patio, and these seem to be taking the place of, you know, those other really critical things in our private realm, but also that accumulate, as Tami's been saying, to give benefit across the whole city, of the productive garden, of the, you know, the biodiversity rich garden, of the heat ameliorating garden. And so, you know, that's part of the mix here and the concern about the way development is systematically changing the nature of our backyards and the benefits we get from permeable surfaces and vegetation.
Yeah, Costa, you're our landscape architect in the chat here today. Yes. What do you see when you're looking at this?
No, I totally hear what Joe's saying. Like what you had and where he was talking about this mentality where housing from the 80s and 90s became this investment commodity, and then it became driven by this real estate mentality of like, oh, well, yeah, you need more rooms and every room should have a bathroom. So you know, there's five bathrooms in a house and then, you know, there's even a portico that should be on a house with a half a kilometre drive in with the big area. It's like a hotel, but you've got this strange architecture to try and, as Joe said, fit all this stuff in. But the consequence of that is, you know, we've lost the green space, that opportunity to have And that idea of an outdoor room, I agree, Joe. Like, it's not, it's actually just another room on the house because it's not absorbing any water. It's creating more heat. It means that this house becomes this energy guzzling thing rather than surrounding it. Because as the subdivision happens, those bigger trees are the first thing that go. And then no one wants trees because, oh, it's dropping leaves into my outdoor room. But no, it's not a room as in a house. So these kind of aspirations have been driven by a commodification that, you know, I want more in my house for when I sell it. But no, we've got to live in it, and it's part of a naturehood. Mm. It's not just this structure. Like, you know, there's a big difference between a house and a home, and building these houses with all these things is actually making a big consequence on the residents that then live in that home, not just the ones that build it, but the ones that follow, because the knock-on effect is less greenery that Joe was talking about.
It strikes me as kind of ironic that part of the reason why we want to have porticos and outdoor rooms at the back is because it's hot. We're looking for shade. But Tami, yeah. these surfaces are generating heat in urban areas. Can you talk me through this process a bit?
Yeah, I mean, when you pave over an area, you're essentially using a big black heat sucking up machine. Asphalt is almost perfect for catching heat. And when you leave it unshaded, it can be 40 degrees hotter than shaded areas in a streetscape. So the evidence is that around 30 to 40% canopy cover, so 30, 40% shade over a suburb, you start seeing the effects of that shade and also the transpiration. So the water that the trees push out through their leaves, that's where you get the cooling, and that's the level of safety, you might say. And studies that, in fact, Joe and I have been working on a little bit lately, looking for neighbourhoods that have got it, they seem to have the combo. They've got big, healthy street trees. So those street trees are, you know, in good soil volumes, they're growing well, they've got access to water. But then there's usually a front yard or a backyard tree that kind of tops it up to that 30, 40 level. And those trees have been retained. A really crucial thing is not just having the space for the trees, but having a setup where the trees get kept in the ground. What we see sometimes in these newer suburbs, they'll have a little backyard, and that tree, you know, that backyard might be built with a tree, but just to have a little bit of movement space, the residents will take it out after a while. So you need those trees to not just be built in, but also kept alive.
Listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. With me is Dr. Tami Kruser, who's the Deputy Associate Director of Regenerative Environments and Climate Action at RMIT, and Professor Joe Hurley from the Centre for Urban Research, also at RMIT, and Costa Georgiadis from Gardening Australia, talking about our shrinking backyards and what we lose in a lot of different dimensions. The social dimension, but really crucially, biodiversity, urban heat, water runoff when all of our surfaces are hard and hot instead of green and luscious. A lot of anxiety about biodiversity on the text line. One says, please address the absolute need for street trees to help counter the lack of green cooling in our cities and suburbs due to housing expansions. Well, yeah, that's really what we were just saying. Lucinda says, I've just returned from 25 years living overseas and I'm shocked at how backyards have disappeared since I left. I grew up in our backyard. Everyone has extended back and sacrificed their backyard for a second bathroom and an extra $500,000 on their sale price. It's hard to even find a house with a decent backyard these days. It's really sad, and I can barely believe how things have changed. Lucinda signs off, by the way, Costa is my hero. Love on the text line for you, Costa. Chris says, I wanted to somewhat recreate my childhood backyard with veggie patches and fruit trees. I bought a corner block with a 33 by 5 metre nature strip on the verge, and the council said that I can plant it out. It's now my giant veggie patch and the envy of many of my neighbours. Corner blocks are usually cheaper too. Life hack. That is some life hack, Chris. Costa, tell me about what you've seen in various cities and communities of using these verges, collaborating to make this this green space there.
Well, I think it was mentioned earlier, I'm not sure if it was Joe or Tani that mentioned that over in Fremantle, like WA's been a real leader when it comes to guidelines and policy to allow people to green their verges. And just last week, I helped judge the Inner West Council here in Sydney, their Verge Garden Awards. And it's the second year that this has run, and I am backing this till the cows come home, because what they're doing is they're saying to people, and particularly in the Inner West, where there's the curb from curb to fence line was concrete, the council will come out, cut the concrete, prepare the soil, and then you can go to their nursery, get 10 free plants, and then put as many others as you want in there. And you know, the thing, Tegan, that I saw from last year to this year, like one of the houses that did it, we were back there this year judging the house next door, which had done one because they were inspired. And then the one on the other side has put their application in to do it as well. So the power of the verge, I think about my verge, and one of the most beautiful comments that I had was a local lady who jogs. And one day, you know, and I've seen her jogging around, and one day she jogged past and she said, your garden is so cool. And I said, ah, oh, you know, takes after the gardener. And she said, and I knew what she was saying, like when she hits my street garden, she said the temperature, she said, I feel it and I love to get here because it's on a hill and it's on a corner. And she said, I get this cool injection. And so what I'm seeing around the country, and I get people saying, oh, our council won't do it. So we can leverage what's going on in Western Australia, what's going on in the Inner West, what started here where I am in Waverley Council, that idea that when other councils are doing it, use them as your leverage point to get the street trees in. Like on the Central Coast, there's gust-growing urban shade trees, and they're working with council to get shade trees into people's front verge gardens. So there are good things happening. There are some councils that are still holding out, but I think the momentum is really building to build these biodiversity corridors because it's valuable real estate.
That's a good point about the value of the real estate, but also where these things are happening. I love it. What I'm hearing, though, is like Waverley Council, Central Coast, areas where it's affluent, people maybe have resources, maybe they have buy-in because they own instead of rent. Tami, we can't just be relying on guerrilla gardeners and people with resources. Like, what kind of policies would help support this so that all types of areas in Australia could benefit from this sort of green shade?
Yeah, I mean, once you're living in the west of Sydney or west of Melbourne, a lot of people out there are commuting 2 hours a day. They might actually not have time to kick in all that incredible community enthusiasm. So I think it's really crucial that we start building these settlements in a way that they don't need that retrofit. And the great news is that there are models out there. They're not common, they're not everywhere, but ways of doing suburbia a bit differently exist. I was looking at something called cluster housing, and it sounds a little bit like what Costa grew up in, where essentially you build a whole bunch of houses that face onto or back onto a common green space. So, you know, Costa had the low fences. This might have no fences or just very limited fences. But it means that, you know, if you've only got a 20 square meter garden each, but there's 10 or 20 of you, then you've got a big enough space if you chip together and you pull down the fences to have a really enjoyable gardening space where you can maybe do a little bit of food growing or play a game of cricket. And generally, if there's a model that you can think of, someone's tried it. These cluster houses exist in Melbourne, in Canberra, in Sydney. They're out there.
Joe, what can we do today to make this the future that we want to be seeing in 10 years' time?
Well, Tegan, you know, I am an urban planner and there's a really important role for policy here. Housing affordability crisis is all over the news, and indeed we do need to increase housing supply, but doing that in sensible ways, in ways that don't systematically erode the really valuable assets of our cities, like our gardens, our private open space, is really important. So supporting good policy and good regulation is critical here to get density in the right locations that's providing quality dwellings in accessible places for people who want that kind of lifestyle, while also ensuring that we're protecting this green infrastructure that exists across the city in the public realm and here, importantly, also in the private realm, is really important. And we are seeing, unfortunately, under the auspices of housing crisis, a bit of a dumbing down of the mechanisms we have to ensure that our development on lots is providing the kind of space, the configuration of buildings that allow for really vibrant, renewing private green space.
Costa, Joe, Tami, thank you all so much for joining me today. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you all. Professor Joe Hurley from the Centre for Urban Research at RMIT, Costa Georgiadis from Gardening Australia, and Tami Cruiser from the Regenerative Environments and Climate Action Group at RMIT University. And thank you for your texts. I've been asking you about your backyard. Fiona says, my kids are luckily having a similar experience to what Costa had as a kid. They wander between neighbours' gardens, building fairy gardens or playing hide and seek with other kids on the street for hours. We're in the Melbourne suburbs, so there's certainly fences between houses, but it isn't stopping the connections between neighbours and garden exploration in our street. It sounds like this isn't common. And just, I guess, a shout out to what is changing, what has already been done. One says, I've lived in Chippendale for 50 years and it has gone from a hot, treeless place to a cool, treed, lively little green space.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music, and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.